I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Thanks for joining us today for The American Idea. I am Kara Rogers-Stevens, Associate Professor of History at Ashland University, and I am your host for this episode. Today, it is my pleasure to welcome back to the show Dr. Lindsay Chervinsky, who recently joined Jeff to discuss her fantastic new book about John Adams. It's titled Making the Presidency, John Adams and the Precedents That Forged the Republic. We had such a great time discussing John Adams on that episode that we invited Dr. Chervinsky back so we could have a conversation about another fascinating facet of John Adams' life, namely his wife, Abigail. As many of you will remember, Dr. Chervinsky did her graduate work at UC Davis. She recently took up the role of executive director of the George Washington Presidential Library. Before that, she was a senior fellow at the Center for Presidential History at SMU. Her first book is called The Cabinet, George Washington and the Creation of an American Institution. So she has a lot of expertise in the first years of the Republic and the ways that our first presidents shaped the executive office and the way that we still think about American presidents to this day. I also happen to know that Dr. Chervinsky is a true fan of the Adams family because her dog is actually named John Quincy Dog Adams, or Quincy for short. And I understand that there are some great photographs of her puppy on her Instagram accounts. Anywhere else we should be looking for those?
Well, thank you so much for having me. Yes, I tend to put them online. Quincy was the world's worst puppy. He was just absolutely relentless. And so one of the things that I taught him to do was to balance stuff on his head and pose for pictures as a way to try and burn mental energy. And that lent itself quite well to then dressing him up as historic figures. So he has been Lincoln in front of the Lincoln Memorial. He has been Washington in front of Mount Vernon. And he, I don't know if you can see in the corner, there's a little tail that keeps popping up right here. He's also a podcast guest occasionally from time to time because he does not like to be outside of the room.
Well, we're very happy to have both of you on the podcast today.
Thank you.
What kind of a dog is he?
So he is an American foxhound. I rescued him actually when he was a puppy, and it turns out he's a purebred American foxhound, which is ridiculous because that is the breed that George Washington created.
I was about to ask. Yeah.
Yeah. So as I was writing my book on the creation of Washington's cabinet, I got a puppy that was one of Washington's other creations.
Wow.
And what makes the story even more ridiculous is Washington created the breed by breeding French hounds that he received as a gift from the Marquis de Lafayette to English hounds that he already had. And the French hounds were brought over from France by John Quincy Adams, which I did not know until after I had named the dog John Quincy Dog Adams. So it's just meant to be all the way around.
What a profound story for a dog.
History has a lot of, yeah, history and dogs, I guess, have a lot of fate involved in them.
Yeah, and America has a long tradition of loving dogs. So that's beautiful. Well, when I was reading your most recent book about John Adams, I was really struck by a line toward the end of the introduction. You say John Adams, quote, received immeasurable support and courage from a marriage that ranks as one of history's greatest love stories. So if you don't mind, set the stage for us. Why does the story of John and Abigail Adams qualify for the Love Story Hall of Fame? What was so special about their relationship?
It's an excellent question. And actually, it's, you know, I always am interested in behind the scenes writing stuff. And so one of the behind the scenes writing things is that one of my reviewers did not like that claim and wanted me to take it out. And I refused. So I feel very vindicated at this moment that you have asked about it.
Good for you.
Thank you. You know, what I love about their love story is that it wasn't the type of necessarily passion that you read about, you know, with Cleopatra and Mark Antony in wars. It was thing that we would necessarily see in sonnets or in poems. It was the type of partnership and marriage that I think most people actually aspire to, which is that 30 plus years into the relationship, they still wanted to be together all the time. They still loved each other's company. They still valued what the other person had to say. And when Abigail was coming to see John in Philadelphia when he was in his presidency, he was so excited to see her because it had been months that he actually went out of the city to meet her so that he wouldn't have to wait so long. And that sort of tenderness, that affection, that enduring commitment to one another, that to me is what is special. And I think their intellectual match is rare in that type of love story, because it's not just that they enjoyed being with one another, it's that they could give as good as they got. You know, Abigail was mostly self-taught, which I'm sure we'll discuss. And yet she could still quote Cicero, and she could quote, you know, Greek and Roman history back to Adams to make his her point to him. And so that type of intellectual powerhouse I find to be extremely compelling.
Absolutely. Yeah, you find yourself sometimes, or I find myself reading their letters, and before I met and married my husband, being a little jealous of their compatibility and the, how much they trusted one another and the level of kind of intimacy, intellectual intimacy that they had. And then very happily, I was also able to marry somebody with a lot of the same interests as I have. So I can have a little bit maybe more appreciation for John and Abigail's relationship. But then set that against the backdrop of the revolution. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, to that point, but like when you read their letters, it's also, it's in some ways so relatable, because if you've been in a relationship for a long time, there are things that you tease each other about and they tease each other about things, and you can see that. And so that accessibility you don't have with someone like George Washington, because he asked Martha to burn their correspondence and she did. And so it just makes them 3D in a way that is hard for us to get at a lot of other revolutionary characters.
Yeah. And I think that perhaps sometimes the teasing element of their relationship can be misunderstood by a casual reader. So I immediately think about Abigail's most famous letter to John from 1776, where she says, "Remember the ladies." And she seems to be making this plea for the founding fathers to include women's rights in their founding documents. And John writes back, and he says that he laughed when he read her letter, and he calls her saucy. And a lot of my students, on first glance, they say, "Oh, well, he's being dismissive of her, and he doesn't care about women's rights." What do you think we need to know about their relationship that might help us understand that correspondence better?
Well, I think what's valuable to know is at that point, they had been married for quite some time. And so this was not a new relationship in which she was asking for women's rights. And at this point, he was away from home especially to be in Congress. And she was taking care of almost everything. So she took care of their families. She took care of their homes. She took care, at this point, she was starting to take care of all of their finances as well. She fully takes over that part of the relationship when he sailed to France, but she was pretty far along in starting to manage the financial part of their home. And so what she was saying, and what the undertone of that letter, is that women often play these roles and yet have no legal protection for their position. So she's really referring to primogeniture and coverture here, which is where property typically would go from male to male, and women would not have a carved out space in the legal system where they could own property of their own. And so either they belonged basically to their father or they belonged to their husband. And this was certainly something they had discussed, because when he was gone, she had limited access to financial documents, to resources, because he wasn't there to give permission. And so that context is essential, and he knows that that's what she's talking about. And they often call each other saucy in a way that is rarely dismissive. It's more of like a recognition of cleverness or humor or a well-honed point, if you know, like when you're debating someone, when they get in a good hit, that's kind of what they are saying. And so what's, I think, important about his response is very much shaped by the political reality of the moment.
Yeah.
But his treatment of her is never dismissive and is always of that as an equal, and recognition of her incredible skills.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I like to point out that John at that time is in Philadelphia being accused of attempting to overturn every order of society, of completely revolutionizing the world through this American Revolution and this rebellion against the King of England, as many portrayed it. And so John kind of laughs that here's another group of people who want him to totally change everything and turn it all upside down. Yeah. But I agree with you. I don't see him as being dismissive of his wife at all, not then and not in any other situation I've come across either. And that context is so important for understanding their correspondence. But maybe we should just get back to basics about Abigail Adams for a moment. So for those who don't know very much about her, what do we need to know about this lady? Can you tell us a little bit about her, her birth, her education? You've mentioned that she was very well read. Had she gone to school, gone to college? What do we need to know about Abigail Adams?
So she was born in November of 1744 in Massachusetts. She came from a long line in Massachusetts. Her family was, you know, among the earliest settlers. She came from a religious family. I often say that it's, you know, it's helpful to understand Abigail as someone who comes from deep Puritan roots, because she embodied the Protestant work ethic. She had sort of a Puritan sensibility about how one ought to conduct oneself. She and her sisters received what was considered to be fairly standard education for women at the time. They were mostly taught by their father. I think they did have a tutor that came in for a short period. They, you know, would have also received dancing lessons and taught to play instruments, but they were not going to an external school. They were certainly not going to college. They were certainly not getting advanced degrees. So that differs quite a lot from John's experience and from the experience of most well-educated men at the time. But she did not stop there. So in those lessons, she would have been taught arithmetic. She would have been taught reading and writing. These were considered essential skills for, you know, if you were to be a good citizen, you had to be able to read your Bible. You also had to be able to manage your own household accounts. And so that's why women needed to know reading, writing, and arithmetic. But she went quite far from there. She was a voracious reader. She read deeply and widely. She liked theater. She liked satire. She liked fiction. She liked nonfiction and history, and did that for her entire life. She read until she couldn't anymore. We know that her education wasn't as good because you can often see her spelling is truly atrocious. Mm-hmm. I mean, conventions about spelling in the 18th century are quite different than our own, but even within her own writing, sometimes she will misspell things differently within like the same week. So, you know, her spelling is kind of all over the place. But you can see in her writings that her sharpness of mind is incredible. Yeah. She had a number of sisters who she was very close to for her entire life. And actually, she originally met John when he was going with a friend to pay who was courting one of her sisters. And they met, they knew each other for a while before they got married. They had a fairly lengthy courtship because he was worried about being able to provide for a family. And if anyone has visited, and I highly recommend if not, the different Adams houses in Massachusetts, you can really see what their life was like if you visit all three, because there's John's birthplace, there's John Quincy's birthplace, and then there's Peacefield, the home that they died in. And when they first got married, they moved into John's birthplace, and it is a very modest, very old, very New England style house. These are not fancy, wealthy people. And she lived right next door to her mother-in-law, too, which must have been an interesting experience.
Oh, that is so interesting. Do you know, was she ever bothered by the fact that her education was not as good as John's? I know there's an interesting history of women's correspondence before the Revolution where women apologized very frequently for being ignorant or for their poor spelling. They were very aware of their inferior educations, and then the experience of the Revolution quite often maybe brought them out of that and made them a little bit more confident. But what about Abigail? Was she ever bothered by this? Did she ever hesitate to advise him?
I don't know that she ever hesitated to advise him. I mean, it's very possible that she apologized for her spelling. I don't recall off the top of my head because she wrote so many letters. It's sometimes hard to remember everything that's in them. She was not lacking confidence. And she was not interested in sort of being falsely demure, which is a word that I didn't expect to reemerge in 2025 parlance, but nonetheless, here we are. She was not interested in that. And so she knew how smart she was, and she knew exactly what she knew and what she didn't know, and was very clear to say when she didn't know about something and when she did know about something. Yeah. She certainly was not shy with him. And so I think that she was very open and willing to express that. However, that doesn't mean that she didn't wish for more. I think she would have loved to have more education. I think she would have loved to have learned other languages. That was something that was always frustrating for her when she was abroad, was that she was limited in her foreign language. And we know, based on studies of the human brain, that if you start to learn languages when you're younger, it's much easier to pick them up. And if you learn as an adult, it's much harder. And so she would have loved to have learned multiple languages when she was a child, and made sure, therefore, that her children did. And I think there were times, especially when she was in places like Paris, where she was surrounded by women who had extraordinary education, that she probably felt that limitation. Often it came through as judgment, because a lot of the women in Paris conducted themselves in a different fashion. They were much more flamboyant in their dress. They were much more flamboyant in their behavior. They were very flirtatious. And so she was very not judgmental Puritan. Of those things. Not Puritan in any way. She did not like fancy French ladies. I think she also resented that they had opportunities for more cultural experiences than she would have had.
Yeah. And you mentioned the level of wealth that the Adams family came from. My impression is that Abigail was never somebody who was overseeing a large community of servants, that she was actually doing a lot of things herself, that she, in a way, sacrificed to take care of the home and the children so that John could go off and serve the country and be one of the founding fathers.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, pay for public servants was not particularly high at the time. It was not a way to make a lot of money, and it was a sacrifice. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whenever we talk about, there's currently a bipartisan commission in Congress right now to create an Adams family memorial. And I think that that's really appropriate, because it was a family project. It was.
So in other words, when you go to Washington, D.C. and you walk around on the mall, you'd actually have a memorial to the whole family.
Yes.
That's absolutely fantastic. I love that idea.
Yes. Yeah. Which I think is great, because there are multiple generations, and B, the women were very involved, and Abigail was. Yeah. One of the things that I think is accurate about the HBO miniseries John Adams is the reflection of the modesty of their lives, especially early on. And you're right, they usually had a servant or two, and I use that language explicitly, because they never owned any enslaved individuals.
That's important, yeah.
And even they did sometimes have black servants, but they were always paid, at least in Massachusetts. I should be very clear about that. When they were in Philadelphia and Washington, D.C., they would sometimes hire out enslaved individuals from families in the area, and those families were paid. But while they were younger in their lives and she was raising their children, they had very little help. And so she did do a lot of things around the house, and often had to care for sick family members, and, you know, oversaw the inoculation of the entire family with smallpox. And that was a really difficult time. And so this was not someone who was waited on hand and foot. This is not someone who was dressed in finery all the time. If you looked at her hands, you would have seen that she worked. And that was a noticeable distinction among other first ladies.
And maybe a reason why she wasn't able to learn multiple languages or do some of the other intellectual things that she might have wanted to. She was consumed with the practicalities of keeping their family going, especially while John was away. And the fact that they were apart so often is both a blessing to us now today, because that's the reason we have so many letters back and forth from John and Abigail, because they spent so many years apart from one another. But I also wonder how that affected their relationship. And I wonder if you have a sense of that. All of these long distance periods, were those beneficial? Did that bring them closer together? Or was that a hard thing in their relationship? They had all of those periods apart.
I think it depends which one we're talking about. So while John was in France and then in the Netherlands, that was probably the hardest time in their marriage, because he was going through a lot of self-doubt. He was very concerned that his letters were going to be captured by foreign agents. And so he just kind of stopped writing. So there were periods of time where up to a year where she didn't hear from him. And you can just imagine what that must have felt like, because it wasn't only that she didn't know what he was thinking or feeling or anything like that, but she didn't even know if he was alive, because there was no way, other way to communicate. Mm-hmm. So that period of time was incredibly difficult. It was probably also the period of her biggest personal growth, because she basically had to be independent in every way possible. Wow. And I think it allowed her in some ways to almost like form her own identity separate from him, which made them even better partners going forward. So it was probably the most difficult time, but also the most formative. Their later separations, especially when he was president, they at that point had kind of weathered so many of these storms. They had figured out what it was like to do what we would call long distance. They did write regularly, and I think those were probably easier. The times that they were together, we, as you said, we don't know what they're saying to one another, which is so hard, because I would love to know that advice that she gave him and the conversations that they had. But especially their time together in London, once she joined him in Europe, I think was probably one of their more special times. They were with some of their children. They were able to explore a new place. She liked the British better than she liked the French. Frankly, they both did. And I think that it was probably a very nice adventure for them.
Huh. Yeah, I noticed in your book, you frequently will quote her letters to her sisters when during those periods when she was with John and he was the president. And so we have at least her words about their experience, because she had, as you noted earlier, that close relationship with family members, but not quite the same as getting those intimate letters back and forth between John and Abigail themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, thankfully, thank gosh, we have those letters, because the ones to her sisters are so full of political gossip and political updates, and often in ways that she doesn't even necessarily, I think, realize she's revealing information. She will often talk about conversations that they had or information she knows. And if you read carefully, you realize that everyone doesn't know that yet, that she is getting access to things before other people are. And so they are such a treasure.
Before we continue with our conversation, I think it's important to take a moment and tell you about our undergraduate honors program in the liberal arts here at Ashland University.
Hi, I'm Rich Police, Associate Director of Student Programs at the Ashbrook Center. The Ashbrook Scholar Program is an honors program located at Ashland University for undergraduate students with an interest in politics, history, and economics. Modeled after a classical liberal education, you will read the great texts, not textbooks. Your classes will be conversations, not lectures. Conversations with other students, with your professors, and with great thinkers and statesmen from throughout human history. If you or a young person you know are passionate about life's important questions, if you want an education that emphasizes discovery, if you value liberal education and the principles of freedom it upholds, then this is the place for you. To learn more, visit us online at ashbrookscholar.org.
One more question for you, just about the John and Abigail letters relationship before we dive into Abigail's role in their marriage and to the nation in general. John and Abigail had nicknames for one another. One of my favorites is from a very early letter where John referred to Abigail as Miss Adorable back when they were still courting. But after their marriage, you'll see a lot of references from John about Abigail. He refers to her as Portia. And this might be a very small, I'm not sure if you know the answer to this, but I'm really curious if you know, why did he pick that particular name? Was that a reference specifically to the Portia in Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice? Or was he actually referring to the historical figure, the wife of Brutus?
That is a really excellent question.
Thank you.
And I will confess that I'm not entirely sure, because although I consider myself at this point to be an expert on Adam's presidency, my expertise is not maybe as in depth for the rest of their life as I would like it to be. But the good news is that I have many years left to continue my historical study. I think it is wife of Brutus. I don't think it's Shakespeare. I don't think it's Shakespeare.
Okay.
But I could be wrong. And I'm sure that an editor at the Adams Papers will listen to this and will tell me I'm wrong. So we will maybe have to circle back and revisit that. But I do know that they also did read Shakespeare. So it is very possible. They're just so regular with their
Roman references that's why that's my guess.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I was looking into this and trying to find an answer to it last night. And the woman who was married to Brutus, she had a really difficult, really tragic life. But at one point, she stabbed herself in the leg to prove to Brutus that she was tough enough to be trusted by him with his political secrets. And then after
that's quite a step.
Right? So I was wondering if this is the way that Abigail choose that name, or did John choose that name as a nod to this historical figure who really wanted to be close to her husband and trusted by her husband and not just thought of as a mere woman. Of course, that would not count at all if they're actually referring to the Portia who's in Merchant of Venice. That is a whole other set of references.
Well, the internet is telling me that I'm wrong, that it was, that it's likely Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice wife, because she was devoted and intelligent, which Abigail was both those things. Yeah. And so I think that, you know what, I think both apply. We're going to just decide both apply, and either are possible.
I like it. What did Abigail call John in her letters?
Usually she called him dearest friend. That was their most, that was their most regular nickname.
I love that. Okay. So what's fascinating about the John and Abigail Adams relationship, in addition to the fact that they were so close, is that Abigail seems to have been a great aid to John in his political career. In fact, you mentioned in your book that Abigail was sometimes referred to as John's cabinet of one, indicating that people were aware that even while he had a very difficult relationship with his actual cabinet, he was going to Abigail all the time for her perspective, even on key political matters, on foreign affairs. I'm wondering, did his political opponents ever mock John Adams for being so close with his wife, or was this an unusual situation for them to have that relationship where she advised him?
It definitely was unusual. I mean, there were women had, of course, ideas about politics, and depending on the relationship, that would shift depending on, you know, their role and their involvement. But her clear involvement and the public knowledge that she was an advisor was rare and was quite remarked upon. And what I think is so interesting is that people either liked her involvement or didn't like her involvement, depending on how they felt about what they thought she was advocating or what position he was taking. So, for example, in 1799, when John Adams sent the Second Peace Commission to France to try and negotiate a peaceful end to that particular conflict, which ended up producing the Treaty of Mortefontaine in 1800, a lot of the extreme wing of the Federalist Party were very displeased. And they said things like, well, if the old woman had been there, she wouldn't have let him do it, saying like they wish, because she had such good judgment and she would have controlled him. And both John Adams heard this in Philadelphia and she heard it in Massachusetts, and they wrote about it and they thought it was hilarious that she would control him, or that she would disagree, that because she so supported this policy. Mm-hmm. But what's amazing about it is that he wasn't offended. He thought this was, you know, quite entertaining, because he recognized the value of her input, but also that because they were partners, like she was not trying to ever control him, but rather advise him. And yet on the flip side, when they felt like she was not on their side, or when she was giving him advice that was contrary to what they were pushing for, they would refer to her as one of the French ladies, saying she was so political that she was like a French lady. And this was, of course, both a nod to the women who would have these amazing get-togethers in Paris where they would talk, they were called salons, where they would talk about intellectual matters and politics and all of that. But they were considered to be too involved in politics. But it is also a double-veiled, like, sort of insult as a prostitute, basically. It's also a reference to a courtesan. And so, you know,
for a Federalist in America to refer to Abigail Adams as a French lady is like calling her a prostitute. Wow.
Yes. And it was in his own party. And so there was this sort of wide recognition that she was a political person, but that was okay or not okay, depending on whether or not people agreed with her or not.
Yeah, that seems to track with human nature.
I think that that's true.
Were there ever times that John and Abigail did find themselves in disagreement on political issues or even personally, or were they constantly in step with one another?
There isn't a whole lot of record of disagreement.
Okay.
My guess is if there was disagreement, it would have been in person. We don't see a lot of record of it in the papers, which doesn't necessarily mean that it wasn't there. I mean, every family that retains correspondence does some editing, and so that is an important distinction.
Yeah.
But I think there were times when she felt very strongly about something, and he maybe was persuaded by that, and I think there's an example where maybe he came to regret it, and that is the Sedition Act in particular in 1798. And she was extremely in favor of the Sedition Act because I think largely because she was quite defensive of him and protective. And I totally understand why. There was no gate outside the president's house. There was no security service. There was no secret service at the time. There was real political violence taking place in the streets. And a lot of the political speech was advocating for violence. And so I think that she was enthusiastic about there being protections trying to limit this type of speech from harming her husband. And maybe she was a little bit more xenophobic than he was. It's hard to say. But she was very supportive of this bill, and he signed the bill, but then later took steps that suggested to me that he had kind of regretted how it had gone, because he appointed to positions of extremely high power a number of people who had been opposed to the Sedition Acts and had vocally criticized them. And so that is my sort of reading in between the lines, and I think about as close as we can get.
Oh, that's interesting. So the Sedition Act is this moment in time where the political opponents of John Adams in Thomas Jefferson's party are perhaps personally mocking and insulting him, and as you mentioned, even at sometimes calling for political violence. The Sedition Act allowed for prosecution of people who criticized the government, and it was specifically aimed at, in particular, editors of newspapers that supported Thomas Jefferson. And this is actually one of my favorite scenes in the John Adams HBO miniseries. Abigail is reading accounts of what people are saying about her husband, and she is just, you can just see her bristling. She's so offended that anybody would say that her husband is toothless or these other kind of just nasty insults. I mean, and by today's standard, they're actually maybe not that bad, but the standards of the time, I agree with you. I can see why she was so offended and she wanted to protect her husband. Did she generally hold grudges longer than what he did? Is that maybe a, I don't know if it's a character flaw, maybe just a risk of loving somebody who's in the public eye?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that she certainly held grudges about him longer than he did about himself, which I do think is a human characteristic. It's a very, very normal thing to have happen. Mm-hmm. And so a great example of that is after the presidency, many years later, Adams resumes his correspondence with Thomas Jefferson. And
yes,
she's aware of it. She's not really ready to forgive Thomas Jefferson. She's sort of like, you know, on the outskirts and occasionally will sign on something, but she never really fully forgave him. And they had been very close prior to the presidency. And so I think that is a good example of her really holding a firmer line. I don't necessarily know if she did the same with herself, because those insults and those slights tended to be, I think, more private than some of the public ones that John endured.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, your book is all about how John Adams shaped the office of the president in these very precedent-setting ways. Did Abigail also set precedents as the second American First Lady? How did she shape that office?
In a lot of ways, she continued what Martha Washington was already doing. So her hosting schedule was quite similar to Martha's. She would hold weekly drawing rooms, which were typically on Fridays where men and women were in attendance. She hosted state dinners. Those were usually weekly, sometimes Thursday nights, anywhere from about 12 to 20 people. And they were people like visiting dignitaries, Supreme Court justices, congressmen, and their wives. And so she was very present with that. And the she also hosted open houses on July 4th and on on July 4th and on New Year's Day. And so those took an enormous amount of time and effort. And in that way, she was following Martha's example. Where I think she diverged and she carved out an option that was not really taken by most first ladies, but is, I think, more expected in the 21st century, is this idea of being a political partner. And there are some first ladies that have done so. Sarah Polk is an example of someone who was very politically active. She was James Polk's basically political advisor his entire career. And when he was in Congress, she would basically hold court for other congressmen to come and get her input. So everyone knew she was political and there was no surprise. I think she was probably the next first lady that had that type of role. And so I think Abigail set the precedent that that was possible, that women could have that type of role, even if it's unelected, even if it's unofficial, being a political actor in that way. It just wasn't, I think, as visibly recognized that that was something they could do until the 21st century, where we now expect them to have their own agenda and to be an advisor in a real way.
Was she like a Dolly Madison kind of a figure, where she's kind of smoothing over relationships on behalf of her husband and kind of being the more warm of the two partners? Or was Abigail's role maybe a little bit more formal in that White House setting?
I think it was more formal. I mean, she could be a very warm and caring person, and she was a great conversationalist. So there's no doubt that she was doing that when she was hosting. And there's no doubt that her hosting created the spaces and opportunities for networking and connections and appointments that were a regular part of the early republic and the political scene. Dolly, I think, was more of a, she was more of a character. She was really a vibrant force, and that actually helped make up for the fact that James was quite quiet and preferred to kind of move behind the scenes and was very good at arranging things in small groups, but in big groups was not. Mm-hmm. So she really took over that public persona in a way that John Adams did not need help with, because he was a bigger character outwardly in public groups than James Madison was. Yeah. So I think that they offered different things in those environments, but the point of the environment was the same.
Well, I just have a couple of final thoughts and questions for you about this relationship as we get to the end of our time here today. One of them is, what lessons on great partnerships do you think we can learn today from what we know about John and Abigail Adams?
They were both keenly aware of their own flaws and their partner's flaws, and they didn't ever really try and deny them or hide from them, and they loved each other anyway, in spite of it. And so I think that that for us is a really good lesson, that you can be very self-aware and still confident of what you have to offer, and you can be a great support to your partner without having to deny what it is that they might be limited in, because that was certainly true of their relationship, and they often poked fun at themselves and at each other in a way that was, you know, calling out some of these weaknesses that I think is really quite, is quite special and something to be, to try to replicate.
That's a really cool insight. I've often thought that marriage might be the art of refusing to get annoyed by your partner and instead choosing to laugh.
I do think a sense of humor is very important to marriage, and I think they probably would have agreed. They definitely had a sense of humor with one another, and that is essential. I think if you can, especially if it's a, you know, if it's a big character flaw, that's a different thing. If it's a small flaw, that's just one of their annoying tics, which everyone has. If you can find it funny, then that's probably better for your long-term mental health.
Yes. Huh. Well, that's beautiful. All right. And then last question. This is a big one. Would America today be the same if John had married somebody else?
No, because America is today what it is, not entirely because of John Adams, but he played a very significant role. He, you know, was the
sort of manager behind the scenes that got the Declaration of Independence passed, that ensured that Thomas Jefferson wrote the first draft, that ensured that Washington was nominated as the commander-in-chief. He drafted the Model Treaty, which served as the model for a bunch of other treaties with other nations. He was instrumental in the Treaty of Paris that ended the Revolutionary War. He drafted the Massachusetts State Constitution, which served as one of the models for the U.S. Constitution. He was the first vice president. He was the second president. He was the main actor in the first two political transfers of power that were peaceful, largely because of his doing. And none of those things would be possible without her, because he would have not had the career he had and the freedom to do what he needed to do if she wasn't taking care of everything at home and, frankly, increasing their financial success, because she was a brilliant investor and a brilliant speculator and made their financial success possible.
Oh, that's interesting. Would you say that she had any role as well in behind the scenes advising him or building him up or encouraging him in such a way that also made him capable of doing all of those things?
100%. I mean, I think at several moments in Adams' career where he is remembered by history, it's because he was willing to do something that was unpopular or be unpopular because it was morally right or it was right for the nation. And if he didn't have someone having his back all the time, it's harder to have that type of political courage.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. This has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. We really appreciate you coming and sharing your insights into the Adams family with us again today. Is there anything that we should say about the Adamses that we haven't gotten to yet?
The only thing is, I alluded to this in my last answer, and Woody Holton has written about this pretty extensively, but Abigail's financial savvy was extraordinary. Sometimes questionable, but extraordinary. She would have her husband send her things back in basically diplomatic pouches, and then she would sell them, which maybe is not totally always a good idea, but she and she was a really brilliant land speculator. And so when we think of their financial success, their ability to buy a bigger house, to take care of their children, it was because she was willing to take risks and he often was not. And that is, I think, a very interesting component to their relationship.
That is fascinating. Yeah, I think we forget today that in the founding era, public service, as I think that you mentioned earlier, it really was a sacrifice. And people expected somebody like John Adams to give up his money-earning career in order to serve the nation, and maybe didn't give people enough credit for how much that could be a financial hit. I know Thomas Jefferson, he should have made a lot of better financial decisions personally, but also in some ways he sacrificed his financial life in order to serve the nation in the ways that he did. So that's a really interesting observation that Abigail helped support John financially. So thank you for that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation. And now I'm going to go read more about the Portia in Shakespeare, because I'm quite curious to know more.
Yes, I am too. All right. Thank you so much again, Dr. Trevinsky, for joining us. And we look forward to seeing everybody again back on our next episode of The American Idea.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.